You're listening to local and regional news on KMUN. I'm Katie Frankowitz. DHS Secretary Mark Wayne Mullen toured Coast Guard facilities on the North Oregon and Southwest Washington coasts last week. Also in attendance were U.S. Representative Marie Glusenkamp-Perez, a Washington Democrat, and Coast Guard Commandant Kevin Lundy. Glusenkamp-Perez says the tours were intended to support the Coast Guard's mission and better understand its resource needs. Later, Mullen visited the Fort George Brewery in downtown Astoria for a Coast Guard event to honor Coast Guard Petty Officer Second Class Tyler Jaggers. The aviation survival technician died on March 5th due to injuries sustained during a rescue operation. Mullen's visit, specifically news of his presence at Fort George, sparked concern and anger among local activists and others. A senior vice president at Fort George says brewery staff did not realize Mullen would be at the event. To read more about this story, go to kmun.org/news. Oregon Republicans succeeded last year in blocking a gas tax increase passed by majority Democrats. Now they're going after a new tax-related bill. Dirk Vanderhart reports.
The bill in question is Senate Bill 1507, a controversial measure that blocked federal tax breaks passed by President Trump from impacting Oregon's tax code. The bill was a crucial piece of Democrats' plan to fill a budget gap this year, bringing in roughly $300 million. But Republicans say it needs to go. No sooner had Governor Tina Kotek signed the bill Thursday than a GOP campaign began an effort to overturn pieces of it.
It hurts a lot of small business and working families disproportionately.
Nick Stark is a chief petitioner in the new effort, alongside State Representatives Dwayne Yunker and Ed Deal. Both Stark and Deal played a central role in sending a gas tax increase to this year's May ballot. They say they're primed to do it again with Senate Bill 1507. The group needs to collect roughly 78,000 signatures by June 4 to put the bill before voters in November. I'm Dirk Vanderhart reporting.
Mount Hood Meadows Ski Resort closed its season Sunday, multiple weeks earlier than normal. Oregon just had one of its warmest winters on record, creating tough conditions for skiers. OPB reporter Joni Auden Land recently visited the resort to see the lack of snow firsthand.
It's kind of steep here, so.
Allison Mariner is driving a large snowcat up the side of Mount Hood. She's headed up to the Cascade Express, the highest lift at the resort at 7,300 feet above sea level. There is a lot of exposed rock and dirt, even at this altitude.
So on the left here, this is kind of an area that would normally be covered in snow during the season. It would get completely full.
Mariner is the slope groom manager here. It's her job to make sure skiing conditions are as optimal and safe as possible. This year, that's been tougher than ever. The snowpack is historically low, less than half its normal amount. Mariner and her crew have spent the season trying to spread that thin layer of snow across the resort. That means hauling up huge amounts of snow up the mountain every night.
Oh, and this is one of those main runs that we work on all the time, constantly pushing snow up the fall line. But that over there, we'll probably lose that in a day. That'll probably be dirt by tomorrow.
As a result, Mount Hood Meadows is closing its season on April 12th, about a month ahead of schedule, meaning seasonal staff will have to find work elsewhere.
Yeah, there's a lot of up and downs this year. Weather-wise, grooming-wise, emotionally, physically, all of the above. It's been a challenging year.
But it's not just Mount Hood Meadows. Dozens of resorts across the country have had to close earlier than normal. Mount Bachelor near Bend closes April 19th. Others have been shut down since February. There simply isn't enough snow on the ground to be sustainable.
So as soon as the sun hits, some of those bare spots, it just grows really, really quick.
Greg Pack is the president and general manager of Mount Hood Meadows. He says the number of visitors here has declined by at least 25% this season, which comes at a cost for the resort.
We were going to do a Nordic Center this summer. You know, that was a $4+ million project. We had to push that off a year. So a ski year like this does impact what we're able to spend and grow with the resort. So we just have to weather it out and, wait till next year.
Of course, such a small snowpack has major implications beyond skiing. Forecasters say there's an increased risk of wildfire and droughts going into the summer. Oregon State climatologist Larry O'Neill says Oregon actually had a fair amount of rain this year, but conditions were terrible for turning all that water into snow.
We had a decent amount of precipitation to build a good snowpack. It might not have been normal. It's just that it was just too warm for too long of a period of time.
That warmth is on full display at Mount Hood Meadows. By 9 a.m., the temperature is in the mid-50s. People start shedding their coats, and the snow feels like it's turning into slush beneath your feet. Drew Bray of Portland just finished his first run of the day on his snowboard, and he's already feeling the heat.
So normally I have like bibs on. I would normally have my huge jacket on and bigger gloves, but right now I'm literally in a long sleeve tech t-shirt and a jersey that I found at Walmart. Like I would easily take all this stuff off.
While it's a pleasant day on the slopes, people here are also aware of the long-term impacts of so little snow. Ashley Hawkersmith of Portland says she's trying to stay positive.
Seeing all the rock this early is disconcerting, just the realities of how it's going to change the way we have access to recreating, but on a day-to-day, you kind of just do your best and be happy with what we can get.
If you know how to fix that, I'll give you a
chance. Let's put a new coat on, yeah.
Most skiers and snowboarders here have a similar outlook, aware that these conditions are not normal, but still grateful for the chance to be outside at all. Still, there's a collective hope that next season will be, has to be, better. I'm Joni Audenland reporting.
Peace Health Oregon's top executive, Jim McGovern, has been placed on leave. This following allegations he violated the scope of his administrative license and attempted to direct patient care in the emergency department. KLCC's Tiffany Eckert reports.
McGovern doesn't have a medical license to practice in Oregon. He has an administrative license. Yet, KLCC has learned that for years, Peace Health's top Oregon executive has been emailing directives to clinicians on how to care for patients, along with dismissals of treatment and refusal to respond to staffing issues. At a special meeting Wednesday night, Peace Health medical staff passed two resolutions. The first called for the removal of McGovern from his position. That happened Thursday night. The second resolution calls for reversal of the decision to replace Eugene emergency physicians with Apollo MD. In a statement, Peace Health said it will proceed with its plans to transition emergency services, and McGovern will remain on leave pending a full review. I'm Tiffany Eckert reporting.
Turning now to news from Washington State. A U.S. appeals court is now considering how to balance the needs of endangered salmon with regional needs for hydropower. That's after President Trump canceled a landmark agreement from the Biden administration to restore salmon runs in the Columbia River Basin. More from KNKX environment reporter Bellamy Palethorpe.
In late February, a U.S. district court in Oregon required increased spill on the Lower Snake and Columbia River dams. In a move that restored parts of the canceled Biden agreement, the judge ruled that more water should go over the dams rather than through turbines where fish can get caught. Environmental groups called it a victory. This week, the Public Power Council, representing about 100 utilities across the Pacific Northwest, filed the latest of several appeals against that federal court order because more spill means less power. And this summer, there's a high potential for wildfires and more strain on the grid, and they say that could mean higher bills for customers and even possible blackouts. They're asking for a pause on the district court's order. I'm Bellamy Palethorpe reporting.
Washington health officials recently announced the state is joining the Global Outbreak Alert and Response Network. This initiative will connect public health officials to infectious disease experts around the world who can provide information about new outbreaks. Washington Secretary of Health Dennis Worsham says this will be useful if the state needs to respond to a future pandemic.
The global network is really assuring that we have the best information in real time to quickly respond to any emerging threats. So our healthcare system is prepared, our public health system is prepared, and the people in Washington have the information they have to protect their health.
This network is operated by the World Health Organization, which the Trump administration withdrew the U.S. from in January. Worsham says joining this initiative ensures Washington will have access to information it previously turned to the federal government to provide. States and cities across the country are also opting to join this initiative, such as California and Illinois. It seemed like getting a whaling permit would be little more than a formality after the Macaw tribe got a waiver to revive its traditional hunt under the Marine Mammal Protection Act. For more than a year now, the tribe's permit application has gone unanswered, but the macaws say they are doing what they can to get ready to hunt as soon as this summer. KNKX Environment reporter Bellamy Pelthorpe has the story from Nia Bay.
Southwest of town in Nia Bay, Daniel Green stands in a grassy clearing on the edge of the Pacific Ocean. There's a reconstructed longhouse here with a painting of a gray whale on its side. Green is from a macaw whaling family. He wanted me to know that we're in what was once one of the oldest of five original macaw villages, carbon dated at nearly 4,000 years old. It's called Wyatch Village.
Yeah, this is where my great-grandfather was born, in one of our longhouses, Quashically bit. And there was four longhouses that were right in this area that were standing out. There's a lot more back then, but this is where my family is from.
He says this is where the most important macaw stories take place of how whaling first began. Green says from the bluffs here, you can see the whales migrating past by the hundreds. He says whale bones are built into the foundations of the houses. He remembers clearing the land near a drainage area when he was a young man in his 20s.
Yeah, just pulling sticker bushes out, you know, whale bones rolling out of the sticker bushes, pretty darn cool. And they're heavy, dense bones, so they're really old, bigger whales.
About 10 miles to the south is where the last whale was taken by the tribe in an officially permitted hunt in 1999. Green trained with that last whaling crew, but he was just a teenager, too young to actually hunt, and the tribe was ordered to stop in 2002. Now 44 with seven children, he says he might be too old, but he's been preparing physically and spiritually, along with others in the tribe who come from whaling families.
You know, to actually fill in that missing piece, to actually go out and do the hunt that you get taught about is, you know, like the culmination of everything.
Green is vice chair of the Macaw Whaling Commission. He says they're now hoping to resume the hunt in July. I spoke with a handful of others. Every one of them wanted the world to know it's time. They're ready. Christopher Martinez is the secretary of the Whaling Commission and chief of staff for the Macaw Tribal Council.
Their folks are training. They're in the water. They're doing their trainings. They're pulling in the canoe and, you know, practicing and preparing for everything that they need to do. And I don't see any real challenge for the tribe and for the whalers other than, you know, not being able to actually go hunt.
They submitted a permit application last March for two hunting seasons from July to October in 2025 and 2027. Federal regulators put it out for public comment, but then never responded and allowed the first hunting season the tribe had applied for to pass.
It's been very frustrating. The tribe's worked, you know, very hard over the last couple decades to make sure that every piece of paper and every environmental impact statement and every, you know, regulation has been met, and you know, the tribe meets that criteria, and to still have a holdup after doing everything on our part is really like infuriating to the tribe.
Now Martinez says they've submitted a new request to amend their permit application so they could start the hunt this summer instead of waiting until 2027. In the wood shop at Nia Bay High School, students chip away at pieces of yellow cedar that they're carving into hollowed-out trays. Traditionally, these would be used for dipping whale and seal oil. Instructor Paul Green says this advanced class also makes clubs for fishing and seal hunting. And there's a small group of kids that loves to carve paddles.
The paddles are a big hit. Functional paddles, hard to come by these days. But here we have kids creating them every week to, you know, use them in the canoe.
Canoes are stowed all around us, even hanging from the ceiling, both for racing and whaling. We're standing next to a red and black one that's 32 feet long.
My students are going to patch it, prepare it, and someday it will probably go whaling.
He says working on the canoes fits in well with the cultural teachings that are integrated into most of the classes at this school, especially the annual Treaty Day teachings in January, when they learn about the Treaty of Nia Bay and the last whale hunt in 99. But reminders of macaw traditions happen all year long. Across Across the way, in language class, students practice their indigenous Macaw language by singing. Seated in a semicircle at desks or on carpeted steps, they hunker down in their hoodies and take turns drumming along. This is the whale towing song.
That is a song that is used when towing a whale in. And a lot of the time, you know, after whalers would get a whale, it would be a time where songs would come to them, a time for prayer and a time for giving thanks.
Hazel Green is the language teacher. She says this song is often shared at big celebrations and public presentations, like Macaw Days. And it's a reminder for her students of the importance of whaling at the very heart of Macaw culture, and the reason why Macaw leaders made sure to reserve these rights in the 1855 Treaty of Nea Bay.
These are rights that we're born with. You are born Macaw. We have these rights. We're currently fighting for those rights, and when we finally can, we'll just be restoring what is rightfully ours.
Her son, Paul Green Jr., is a paraeducator for language and helps sing the songs here. He also traveled with a delegation in January to perform at the Smithsonian's National Museum of the American Indian, where the agreement signed in Nea Bay was installed in a rotating exhibit of treaties. Theirs is the only one that explicitly promises the right to hunt whales. Green says he hopes the display might tip the scales in their favor as they wait for a whaling permit. He says it's not about a trophy hunt.
You know, it's a way of life for us, and a lot of people don't like what they don't understand and just understand that it's our way of life, and everything that we do about it, it's in a good way, and it's not with any intention of just killing for fun. It's taking a life and honoring it in the best way that we know how.
The tribe invited representatives of the Department of Commerce to their treaty ceremony at the museum in D.C. because right now they say the decision about their whale hunt is in the hands of Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick. Commerce did not respond to requests for comment, but media reports describe a backlog of contracts with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration piled up on Lutnick's desk. NOAA agreements for weather forecasting, marine fisheries and coastal management, and the Macaw's whaling permit all remain in limbo. I'm Bellamy Palethorpe reporting.
Bellamy Palethorpe covers the environment beat at KNKX, including stories about food sovereignty. Find more of her coverage and her email to send her story ideas at knkx.org. You're listening to local and regional news on KMUN. It's brought to you by our news partners and by the KMUN News Department. That's all from us for now. Up next, the American Democracy Minute.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government buy-in for the people. The California Supreme Court temporarily halted a Riverside County Sheriff's investigation into the 650,000 Proposition 50 redistricting referendum ballots he seized last month. Unsealed evidence used to secure the warrant confirms it came from an election denier activist group, not state elections authorities. The state's high court paused the quest by Sheriff Chad Bianco, a GOP gubernatorial candidate, to find 45,896 of the county's 657,322 ballots cast, ordering him to, quote, show cause before this court. The same day, a lower court unsealed the affidavits used to obtain three warrants for February 9th, 23rd, and March 19th, prepared by Sheriff's Department investigator Robert Castellanos. The affidavits confirm that the evidence was provided by the Riverside County Election Integrity Team, a citizen activist group, alleging, quote, various issues regarding potential election fraud, unquote. The document referenced no evidence from the California Secretary of State's election investigators or other authorities. CalMatters reports that it's also unclear whether the county attorney signed off on the affidavit. The warrants were all signed by Judge Jay Keel, whose election Bianco endorsed. We've linked to the unsealed affidavits at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org. I'm Brian Beal.
This is KMUN.